Welcome to Veterans Voices UK, the podcast where we bring you the most remarkable stories of British military veterans from across the generations. In each episode, you'll hear the voices of those who've served our country, from the heroes of the Second World War to those who've served in more recent conflicts. But these aren't just war stories, they're stories of life, service, and the lasting impact their military service can have long after the uniform is put away. I'm Matt Lehman. Today, I'm delighted to introduce Pat Moyer. Pat's story begins with a remarkable family connection to military history. His father served during the First World War with a machine gun corps and was badly wounded, while Pat himself would eventually follow a very different path into the British Army. But before joining up, there was already a taste for adventure. Pat left school to work at sea, first with the Trinity House pilotage and later on board dredgers, before eventually exchanging civilian life for army service. He initially joined the Royal Signals, but his career would take another turn when he transferred to the Royal Horse Artillery, the regiment with which he would form the strongest military bond. During his years in the army, Pat served overseas, spent time in Hong Kong, and completed tours of Northern Ireland during some of the most difficult years of the Troubles. He would also spend time with the Army Youth Team, passing on his experience and skills to a younger generation. But Pat's story doesn't end when he leaves the Army. There would be another career, retirement, personal loss, and eventually the distinctive scarlet uniform of a Chelsea pensioner at the Royal Hospital Chelsea. There's plenty of humour along the way, but there's also memories of service and friendship that, more than half a century later, has never entirely left him. So here it is, Pat's story.
I'm Pat Moyer. I was born in Ilford in 1944. My mother and father were both civil servants. My father was in the agriculture and fisheries, and my mother was in the War Office. They met during the war because they were both posted to Blackpool to get away from the bombing.
But am I right in thinking, Pat, just to take you back one there, that Dad had got something of a distinguished military career in his own right?
Yes. In the First World War, he was in the Machine Gun Corps, attached to the City of London Regiment, which was Second Royal Fusiliers, and he won the Croix de Guerre, Passchendaele. He was in the Fifth Army under General Gough, and in the big push that the Germans were pushing us back, General Gough was sacked in disgrace, and the French took over the Fifth Army. That's why my father ended up getting a Croix de Guerre instead of the military medal. And he was badly wounded. Basically, a hand grenade ended up underneath the machine gun and really made a mess of his stomach. He lay on the battlefield all night unconscious, and his hair turned white. When daylight turned up, he crawled back towards the road, and a group of German soldiers who had been made prisoner, but most of them had been killed, including the guards, by artillery shells. They picked him up, fastened him to a stretcher, carried him down the road, and they came to a place called Soissons, where there was a first aid post run by the French, and they were so impressed that my father single-handedly captured 12 German soldiers. In actual fact, they saved his life. So he was awarded the Croix de Guerre. And when he got back to England, his mother came to visit him in hospital in London, and his hair was pink because it had gone white overnight, and then it was stained pink with his blood from his stomach wound. And I can remember as a boy when he used a bath, I could see his stomach was a mess. And I think he was in hospital for a year before he came out. And he ended up working for the civil service as a chemist. And his first job was to find out how much sugar was in cans of fruit from Australia so they could put the sugar tax on them. Then later on, the agri-fish was posted to Blackpool and St Anne's, to Moreland Road, which later on became the Premium Bombs HQ. So they moved the Ag and Fish back to Southend, and my father did not want to live in Southend. In World War II, it posted to Blackpool. Along, my mother was also posted. She was in the War Department. And his job was an air raid warden, and he used to be on fire watch on the top of Blackpool Tower. And the idea being was he could see if any fire started from bombs, because the Germans were bombing Liverpool, and as they came out of the bomb run, they used to circle over the Irish Sea and come over Blackpool, because obviously he used Blackpool Tower as a marker, and he was able to see what was happening.
Pat, thanks for that. I mean, it's unbelievable that he served, you know, as you, I believe it was with the Machine Gun Corps in World War One, and then goes on to do a really important in World War Two. What kind of a character was Dad, and what kind of character was Mum as you were a young child growing up?
Oh, well, my father was very, very strict, and he wanted me to be a pen pusher, which obviously wasn't good for me. My mother was absolutely lovely. She understood me and always supported what I wanted to do. But now my father was very, very disappointed when I failed 11 plus. And my mother, she bought me a lovely blazer with a badge on it for the just opened secondary modern school, Ansell County. And my father used to keep jabbing his finger at the badge and saying, "Badge of shame." So I was a great disappointment to him. But luckily, 10 years later, my sister passed her 11 plus and went to grammar school. But funny enough, years and years later, when we were both grown up, my father used to keep saying to my sister, "Why can't you be more like your brother?" So it couldn't have been that bad.
So we fail our 11 plus and we go on to a secondary modern school. Did you enjoy school?
No. No, I didn't enjoy school. I was a bit of a reprobate. My nickname was Rawhide because I used to get the cane so often. Very rarely on the hand, he was always on the backside. He used to bend over. And I'm sure in them days we didn't understand what a pervert was, but the deputy head, I'm sure, was because he used to rub chalk on his cane so they could hit you in the same place. So when you got six of the best, you only had one scar on your backside, not six, which a normal teacher would give you.
Pat, thanks for that. So by the late 1950s, school's over and it's time to get a first job. I believe you worked somewhere before you actually joined up in the army. Can you tell us about that first job as you left school?
Yes, so I worked as a deckhand with Trinity House Pilotage on a pilot cutter, which was an ex-45-foot Scottish canoe-stern trawler. And the skipper was very young, but he was very clever. He was immaculate. And mainly being this, we had a terrible storm, false nine gale, in which a ship called the Druid, which was owned by a Scottish family and run by the family, it was the mother and father and the son, and that capsized and they all drowned. And the day afterwards, I was on board. We went out there and you can't explain it. We were in about 2 miles offshore, and the waves were 30 foot high. You were literally like going up a mountainside and down the other side, which was more of a swell than, it didn't have the white caps, but it was just such huge and it was frightening. But the skipper was absolutely brilliant. And we did a very dangerous manoeuvre, having to turn round. So we were in the bottom of a trough and he span the wheel round, bang, the accelerator down. And to me, that was quite amazing. Shortly after that, a firm called Westminster Dredgers had a contract to dredge the River Ribble, and they were looking for a lad with local knowledge. So I left the Trinity House and joined them at double the money, because what it was the skipper of the tug, the Westminster Dredger Drake, was the son of one of the owners. So of course, he was getting plenty of money, and of course, that meant I did as well. So after working there, we went up to the Manchester Ship Canal. We were dredging the canal, and instead of having to go all the way out to sea to dump the spoil, we would then go to Warrington, and the mud was sprayed onto the ground to make the bridge for the M6 to go over the Mersey and the Ship Canal. So that paid a lot of money. I think we got £1 a day bonus for each barge load of mud that we moved, and I think we were doing 4 or 5 a day. So that was good. But unfortunately, we then had the horrible winter of 63 when the sea froze. And obviously that was me out of work because we were all laid off. So Livingston Towns was bad for work. The only work there was Freeman Bonds, really. And everybody I went to school with ended up working there. So I went to London and ended up working in a shop in Oxford Street selling ex-army stuff with Headquarters and General Supplies.
So, Pat, in the early 1960s then, we finished being the shop worker in Oxford Street and we go off to join the army. Am I right in thinking that you wanted to join the Port and Maritime Regiments because of your time with Trinity House and your time on the dredgers?
Yeah, that is correct. But I was informed that there was no vacancies, so I started going through all the trades like marine engineer, and then I said, well, radar operator. Oh, this you want to be a radar operator, do you? And I said, yeah. He said, they're all signals for you, lad. So I was given 2 days' pay, the Queen's shilling, and a railway warrant to Darlington in Yorkshire because I was going to the Royal Signals depot at Catterick. And I loved every minute of it. It was really, really great. My father didn't want me to join. And funny enough, 14 years later, when I wanted to leave, he didn't want me to leave. But my mother, God bless her, she was always supported me. But Catterick was absolutely brilliant. I loved every minute of it. And then to crown...
Can you remember some of those early days of... Yeah, I mean, everybody still refers to it as their square-bashing courses.
Oh, yes. Well, we had Sergeant Swankey and a Corporal Dooley. Well, these two, between them, knew every trick to get money out of us. It was really bad. We had to put so much a week to them to pay for our piss-up when we had our week away in the Lake District. So after a week away and we had the piss-up, and I had 2 pints, they then said, oh, we drank too much, so we all owed them money, so give them some more money. Then he comes in, one of them had lost his wallet, so we'd have a whip round for him. Then one of them, his mother had died and he wanted to pay for the funeral, so the whip round for that. It was everything. Anyway, the course after the next intake, one of the boys was an officer's son and he knew that it was not right, so he bobbed him and he got kicked out of the army and he became an insurance salesman, which I suppose really suited him. And I went to Birkenau in Germany. It was a beautiful little village on the banks of the river, and which I loved because I was a fisherman. So in the summer, every night after work, I'd be down there fishing. And then after 2 years, being signalled, you get a posting. And with the signalled, you get posted as an individual. They said to me, well, would you like to go to the RHA? I said, OK, where are they? And they said, oh, they're in Kenya. So I thought, well, yeah, because my brother was a special policeman during the Mau Mau thing in Kenya. I'd love to go there. Well, what they didn't tell me was that, okay, RHA were in Kenya, but they were coming to Germany. So I ended up going to Detmold, which is not nowhere near as nice as Birkenau, and spent 5 years there, attached to 3RHA, and then... In 66, they disbanded the signals troops, and I was then in the regimental skiing team and basketball team, and I didn't want to leave, so I, along with a couple of other lads, I rehat-badged, became a signaller, and the interesting thing was a B-1 signal in the RA got the same money as a B-1 radar operator in the signal. The only difference was the B-1 signaler exam was no harder than the B-3 raw signals operator. So that was quite handy. So I was a B-1 within months rather than having to wait about 4 years it would have taken the signals.
So, Pat, after a short time doing your recruits course and your basic trade training with Royal Signals, you end up eventually with the RHA, Royal Horse Artillery, and change cap badge and become an RHA soldier. Looking back now on life, do you feel as though your allegiance was with the Royal Signals, or do you feel that it was with the RHA?
Oh, with the RHA. Because obviously you've got 10 years with them, I suppose. Longer. And also, of course, did 5 tours and all 9 with them. And when you go through some of the horrors that we actually went through, and also losing a very close friend, that creates a bond that you don't get anywhere else. You can't explain it. If you haven't been there, you can't, you don't know. It's what it was like. The first thing that happens is when you get your first riot and your first shot at is, I felt quite proud of myself because I hadn't vomited. I got what they call a Honda 50s. My knees sort of rattled a little bit. I survived it, and I felt quite pleased because up to that, I didn't know how I would react when people throwing petrol bombs at you. Everybody in front of you wants to kill you, and they do. They wanted to kill you. After the first riot, I did feel quite proud of myself. But later on, when the soldiers started dying, particularly the 21st soldier to die, which was Paul Chandler, lovely, lovely man. And he just had a baby son, which was 2 weeks old when he died. And he'd only seen him once. And what had happened was, we just finished a tour of Ireland, and we came back on the Monday. He went to the hospital to see his wife and the baby, and on the Thursday, they turned us round and sent us all back to Ireland. And yeah, when we got to Ireland, we went to St. David, I think it was a place called St. David's Camp, pouring down with rain, and we were absolutely soaked. And they put us in the aircraft hangar, and we literally all lay on the concrete floor to the early hours of the morning, and then we were bussed out in Land Rovers, 4 or 5 to each Land Rover, to people's front doors, and we just kicked the doors down. And basic thing was, you ran up the stairs and you were told the age and the name of the person you're going to arrest. Our overlook we had was screaming and shouting and shouting. So someone said, shut up. So he said, hit him. So Titch brought his rifle down on his arm and broke his arm. Later on that day during the riots, one of our soldiers had his arm broken. So he got £50 compensation from the mayor of Belfast, where the IRA man, he got £500 compensation. But we had a lovely guy, it was a friend of mine called Paul Chandler. When we ended up in Londonderry, he was on an OP, which in the old shirt factory in Londonderry, is it Laddish Drive? Anyway, it's a big tall metal chimney, and the OP was in the top of it. And there was 2 guards in there, one of them was full. And a car came along, parked in the road outside, blew his horn. So he stood up to look down at the car, and the sniper was in the house across the road, shot him in the chest. And had a hell of a job. A very good friend of mine was the battery medic. Can you imagine getting in a narrow chimney with a wrought iron ladder, getting him down. Anyway, they got him to hospital, and they thought he'd live because he'd lost. But anyway, during the night, he died. So, of course, rumours started, oh, a nurse has pulled the plugs out, and all that. Of course, they didn't.
Pat, one of the things I chatted to you before we started recording was your time when you spent with the Army Youth Team of the RHA, and I believe you was a climbing instructor.
Yes, it was the best posting, as it was a two-year posting, but I ended up doing 5 years. So it was in Mill Hill, which in London, which was the Army's Royal Engineers postal depot, where they did all the mail. And basically, during the winter, we went round in the evenings to youth clubs and schools, giving lectures on map reading, all for the Duke of Edinburgh Bronze and Silver Award schemes. And then in the summer, we used to take them out on exercise, like with hill walking, rock climbing. But, oh, I absolutely enjoyed it there. So working with young children, it was good to be doing something useful, teaching the good side of it, what I'd learnt in the Army.
Pat, like all of us, eventually our time in uniform comes to an end, and I believe in the late 1970s your time in the Army came to an end, but you were still looking for a bit of adventure, and you used your skills as a rock climber to get your first job, is that right?
Yes, there was an advert in the Coventry Evening Gazette, ex-rock climber required for tree surgeon. So I thought, oh, I'll have a piece of that. But that was the worst job I'd ever done in my life. I was come back home, black and blue, bleeding, covered in dirt, and my eyes full of, all sorts of full of sawdust. And so basically, you basically would climb, there was all working to you, had a big hefty bloke who manned the ropes and stayed on the ground, and skinny blokes like me climbing the trees. So all the ropes would go to the top of the tree. One would be tied to me and one would be tied to the brass that you were cutting. But what you had to do when you cut the brass, it would swing towards you. You had to then twist round the tree. And if you weren't quick enough, you would run up your arm and all. So I didn't do that for very long. And the money was absolutely terrible. I left that job and I got a job with the Royal London Insurance Company, which had just opened their headquarters in Colchester, a lovely, beautiful building called the Octagon, because it wasn't shaped like a nine, it was shaped like an eight. And I think it cost £12 million to build. So I started off there as a commissionaire come chauffeur. I worked there till I was 53. And then obviously they had a very good pension scheme, and I took early retirement and retired at 53. And I got my army pension early as well. And then I lived a life of leisure, basically. I bought a caravan on the seafront in Mersey Island. So we lived there all through the summer and then came back home to Colchester in the winter. And basically I just fished every day. It was a lovely life. And my wife loved it because a lot of other ladies on the site, and they all used to sit in that all day. Yeah, life was good, very good. My wife, Anne, who I met in Ireland, and basically what happened was we used to get 2 days R&R. After 2 days, my father took me to Manchester Airport, got there, and there was a flight going early. And they said, oh, we want to go on the earlier flight. So I said, oh, I'll go on it. So I got on the earlier flight, which meant when I got to Belfast, there was no transport waiting for me. But there was transport going to Sunnyside Street TA Centre, where one of the batteries was. I thought, if I go there, then there's transport, because they have a disco on that night, we'd be going from there to the police station where I was based. So I got the transport to the TA Centre, walked in, the dance was going, and mate mounted. Yeah, I bet you can't get a dance with that big blonde bird. Says, OK. So I walked up to her and said, would you like a dance? She says, I can't dance. I said, oh, I'll show you. So he got on the dance floor and said, you can't dance either. We hit it off straight away. Anyway, she wanted me to meet her brother-in-law and sister. So what I did was I did something I swore I'd never do, and that was be caught skirt chasing. I had a job with two gunners guarding the safe house in Sibbys, and got a taxi to this house. I jumped in with her. And then we went round to a brother-in-law's and sister's. But unfortunately, we had to go through very bad area, the markets area of Belfast, where there was a police station. One of the batteries was guarding the police station, and there was a bit of a riot going on. The crowd were attacking the police station, and J battery all lined up outside. The crowd stopped throwing stones at the taxi passed. I thought, crap, if they see me short haircut, they're going to kill me. And if J battery see me, I'm going to get busted for being out. So I lay on the floor, pull my gun out, lay on the floor of the taxi. Anyway, we got through okay. We planned to get married in the August. August the 10th, I think the date was. But unfortunately, the regiment by then was known by the local newspaper as the Yo-Yo Boys, because we were going backwards and forwards so often. Was sent back to Ireland and ended up in Londonderry. And it was November before we got married when I finished that tour. And then in February, we poached to Hong Kong. And the great thing about Hong Kong was you didn't have to do any tours of Ireland for a couple of years. And there we were blessed with the birth of my daughter, Justine. Again, I was very, very lucky because I'd been with Trinity House Piloted and the thing about... In Hong Kong, you had to pass a proficiency test to take boats out. So I took the exam and I got the local master's and engineer's certificate. And because I had that, the officer said, oh, they made me boatswain of the Army Yacht Club. So for 2 years, I was running around just a pair of shorts on, doing what I love, working with boats. So we did water skiing and sailing, and it was absolutely brilliant. And Anne wasn't very happy with the Army, so because of her, I came out, gives me 18 months' notice, and we went to Colchester, where sadly, Anne died of a heart attack in her sleep, so she didn't suffer. I was a member of the Royal Signals Association and we used to meet up in Merville Barracks with the Power Signal Squadron there once a month, and a chap came from Chelsea to give a talk about the Chelsea pensioners. So I applied and I went up there for a week's trial. They look at you, see if they like you, and you look at them if you like them. And if you like each other, you get invited to stay. So I did. And
so, Pat... we leave the Army. Sadly, we lose Anne, and it's the opening for you to go to Chelsea. Did you enjoy your time in Chelsea? It's a place that carries enormous sort of, momentum. The Chelsea pensions are loved wherever they show up anywhere in the country. I mean, it must have been a very proud moment when you were accepted after your trial.
Oh, it was, I know. Absolutely loved it then. There were so many different activities to do. Like, I joined the pottery class, and learned a lot and did loads there. We had a bowling green, but it was on a slope. Also, I was on the volunteer group where we visited schools, so basically it'd be assembly, and you'd give a talk. We learned, kids used to ask stupid questions. Like, some of the kids heard somewhere that different uniforms had different types of buttons. So one kid said to me, why have you got 9 buttons? Just as well, I've got 9 buttonholes, you know. So that was really, really enjoyable. So all the activities there, then we called to the clubhouse, and I used to call the bingo. What you might not know about Chelsea is the most recent part of it is called the MTI, which stands for the Maggie Thatcher Infirmary. And it's called that because Maggie and her husband raised £2 million to have it built. And in her honour, her and her husband's ashes are actually under the patio at the front of the hospital. We don't tell people where they are, visitors, but the clue is there's always a bunch of flowers on the flagstone where they're buried. Right, well, the criteria for being in Chelsea is old men, broken by age and war, unencumbered by spouse. So when I met my wife-to-be, the lovely Carol, and I became encumbered, I had to leave. But we still go up there quite often for different things. And it's a wonderful institution, it really is.
Is there anything you'd like? I mean, we have listeners on here that reach right around the world from the podcast, Pat. I mean, Chelsea Hospital is internationally known. I mean, do you think it's something that we should grow, or do you think it being that sort of small select grouping as it is that the perfect thing? Do you think we should have a larger Chelsea Hospital?
Well, it used to be large. It used to be 500 strong. It's now only 300 strong. But because the army has shrunk, they're finding it hard to put, there's always vacancies. At one time, there would be a waiting list for years.
Marion Carroll, part of the agreement is to be a Chelsea hospital, or a Chelsea pension, sorry, is that if you do get married, you have to leave. Was it disappointing when you left?
Not when you've got a lovely lady like Carroll. No, she was definitely worth giving you up for. But if I lost Carroll, I'd definitely go straight back there.
We'll say goodbye to Chelsea Hospital. And we've moved down to Kent. We live in I've got to be honest, an absolutely gorgeous little spot down here. 12 acres. It's a livery stable that Carroll's had for some time. But am I right in thinking that the passion down here actually is rescued dogs and a bit of a donkey sanctuary?
Yes. Practically every animal here is rescued. All the chickens and the ducks are rescued. We've got three full-sized donkeys and we've got three miniature donkeys, which belong to the donkey sanctuary, and we just look after them. The dogs, they're all from Serbia's Forgotten Paws, which is a charity. But living here is absolutely amazing. Originally, Carol and her husband, they rented it because it was bought by British Rail for when they were building the Channel Tunnel. They bought loads of plots of land. So Carol and her husband rented it, and then when they chose the route for the tunnel, they then sold off all the land they didn't need. So Carol and her husband, they bought it. They had sheep here at one time, but now it's just horses. We've got an old horse here which they bred called George, and he's a wonderful horse. He goes all over the place. He nicks other people's horses' food. He knows all the bins. I can open the bins with his.
So, Pat, we've retired to what you've just described as an absolutely almost a dream spot down here in Kent, and you clearly are enjoying life. I mean, if we just look back on a life there that started in Ilford, that took you to Lancashire, working for Trinity House, your time to want to join the Port Maritime Regiment in the Army, ending up in the Signals, transferred to the RHA, some awful times, I have to say, that we've chatted about in Northern Ireland and a loss of very good friends. And then you gave it back to the youth of today with 4 years in the Army youth team with the RHA, and, you know, you fed it back to the children and helped them in their futures. Tree surgeon probably didn't work particularly well for an ex-rock climber. And then time as a driver, as a chauffeur and a commissionaire for a large insurance company before you retired. And then sadly lost your first good lady, Anne. And then to Chelsea. I mean, it has been an absolutely amazing life. If you were to look back on it today, Pat, is there a couple of things in there that you would say are my absolute highlights, of things I'm so glad this happened or I'm so glad I did that?
Oh, all of it, really. If I had to do it, I'd do exactly the same.
There's nothing you'd change then?
If I could change anything, it would be not letting Paul go up that bloody chimney and getting shot. That really, because he was a lovely man. There's no two ways about it. As they say, they always say the good die young, and they certainly do. But I still have nightmares about that. No, I wouldn't change anything.
Pat, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you so much indeed for speaking to us, and I wish you all the very best.
Okay, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
As we start to close this episode of Veterans Voices UK, I'd like to thank Pat for sharing such a remarkable life story with us. From working at sea as a young man to years in the British Army, tours of Northern Ireland, service overseas, and eventually becoming one of the famous Chelsea pensioners, Pat's story takes us across more than six decades. There's been plenty of humour in today's conversation, and I think Pat's character comes through very clearly. But towards the end of our interview, there was also a moment that perhaps tells us something about the importance of military service. When I asked Pat whether there was anything in his life he would change after everything he'd experienced, there was only one thing. It was stop his dear friend, Paul Chandler, going up that chimney in Londonderry, where he was shot and he later died. More than half a century later, Pat told me he still has nightmares about that very day. It's a powerful reminder that friendships forged during military service can last a lifetime. But so too can the memories of those who never come home. That is one of the reasons that Veteran Voices UK exists, simply not to record military history, but to preserve the personal stories behind it, told by the men and the women who were actually there. If you've enjoyed hearing Pat's story, please follow Veterans Voices UK on your favourite podcast platform. Leave a review and consider sharing this episode with someone who may enjoy it. And if you know a veteran with a story that deserves to be heard, recorded, and above all remembered, I'd be delighted to hear from you. You can find out much more through our website at veteransvoices.uk. But above all, thank you, our listeners, for being with us today. Until next time, I'm Matt Lim, and this has been Veterans Voices UK.